Welcome to The Lisa Show with Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Do you find yourself in more disagreements than you'd like? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to talk about how to disagree without being disagreeable. And in 15 minutes in your morning buzz, it's the number one Google search today. Find out whose career is ruined by a burrito. Sexual abuse and domestic violence are among the most awful crimes committed. It leaves their victims scarred and scared, leaves them in a lengthy recovery process. And the hardest part of this recovery is oftentimes that first step, opening up, seeking help. So we admire those who make it easier for those to find the help that they're looking for. And today we're talking to one such organization. We're talking specifically to Casey Nichols, who is a part of Wings of Hope, a domestic violence shelter that focuses on sexual assault, stalking, and domestic violence. They have a 24-hour crisis line, as well as a safe shelter that can serve up to 10 families. Welcome, Casey. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for having us on.
We love to highlight organizations that are really making a difference in different parts of the country. We'd love to highlight really what Wings of Hope does. How did it get its start, and what are the different services that you offer?
Yeah, so Wings of Hope has been in existence for 41 years. We got started in, I believe it was 1979, and it was a grassroots organization that really sprang up from the community. They saw a need to be able to help victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking, and that in our area we did not have those services, and so they founded it, and that's how it has gotten its start and has become what it is today. We provide all sorts of services to survivors. We provide our crisis line, which is really, you know, the first step that a lot of people take is reaching out. And then we will connect them to other services such as counseling. We have classes. We have support groups. We have a way for them to be able to file protective orders or restraining orders against their abusers. Really all sorts of ways to be able to assist them.
The narrative that we hear certainly as a country and as we're coming out of the pandemic is that domestic violence and abuse is on the rise. Is that something that you've seen in your particular area there in Oklahoma?
Yes and no. So during the pandemic, certainly we did see a rise of requests and services, especially for shelter. Hmm. Now we're seeing it decline a little bit because survivors are able to go back to work and go back to families a little bit more and escape and be away from their abusers a little bit more often than they were able to during the pandemic.
And as far as being able to offer all of these different services, where do you get your funding?
So our funding really comes from our community, from donors. We also do have a few grants that can provide for us, which obviously we seek out, but all of that money is earmarked. So it's going specifically to maybe something like education or alternative housing. But really it's our donors that make the biggest difference.
With such a need and such a varied offering of services, how are you able to as we mentioned kind of in the intro of this whole thing, really be able to onboard people? That first step is the most difficult one for many. How are you encouraging those people to be able to speak up or to be able to speak out in a way that maybe others aren't doing or in a way that you guys find to be successful?
It really depends on the individual. Whatever they're most comfortable with, really, we are all about safety, hope, and empowerment. So first, we're going to make sure that person is safe enough to speak out. And secondly, we want to empower them to be able to tell their stories in a way that they feel is the most empowering for them. And also, usually, people want that specific thing to not happen to another person. So the more stories that are heard, the better, really.
If you're just joining in on the conversation, we're talking with Casey Nichols from Wings of Hope, which is a domestic violence shelter that focuses on sexual assault, stalking, and domestic violences. And I appreciate you telling us the kinds of services that you offer and how you've been able to help women in this situation. And now I'd like to get to sort of like a broader understanding of such a difficult topic. You mentioned earlier that you want to provide for these women what it is that they need, and you don't know until they come to you and that they're vulnerable in that. And I'm wondering, since the Me Too movement and that push towards opening up and talking about things that typically we didn't, have you seen more people be vulnerable about past experiences with the hopes that it won't affect someone else in the future?
Among the younger generation, I would certainly say that's the case. Yes. We do have a large college here in Stillwater, and we do see more college students, I believe, coming forward and speaking. And I believe it's not only because of the Me Too movement, but also because they know that their friends understand the more complex issue, and they know that they have the support of their friends and their family. And I believe that that makes it a little less intimidating for some of those survivors.
With the introduction of friends, if we are a friend or we have a loved one that we either suspect or know that, you know, abuse is going on, if at the request of that individual, oh, don't say something, or I'm going to take care of this, or whatever the things may be, how can we best support them if they aren't ready to speak out?
So the best thing you can do is really do a little bit of safety planning with them. Talk to them about how they're going to stay safe and to kind of keep those things in mind. It may be allowing them to sleep on your couch for a night, or maybe saying, hey, I will call the police if you want to text me a code word, something like that.
Oh, wow.
The best thing to do is to listen to them and see how you can help in their situation without necessarily having to report it. Just be that confidant, be there for them, because sometimes listening is actually one of the most supportive things you can do.
For those who are listening who love what you're doing, they really want to help, how can they get involved with your organization specifically?
Yeah, so they can go to our website at wingsofhopeok.com, and they can ask about volunteering, or they can get involved with donating money. We have a way to do that on our website as well. So volunteering and donating are really the biggest ways to get involved and to help.
And for those who don't live in your area and who are listening and thinking that this is an important issue either to them personally or they see a need in their community, what's your best advice for them?
Yes, I would say find your local shelter, your local crisis line, your local organization that's getting involved with domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, and to ask them what they need. I believe it will probably be a very similar answer, will probably be volunteering their time or donating money. Sometimes you can get involved on their board of directors or something like that and get involved in fundraising for the organization, things like that.
If someone just wants to be more educated about this, maybe they don't have someone in their life, but they would like to be more keenly aware, and maybe that's why they don't think there's someone in their life that's doing this. Where is a great source of information or training or, you know, those kind of things where people can find about this?
Yes, so there are tons of resources online, but the National Network to End Domestic Violence is really the place to go and look into that. It's really for everybody in the U.S., and they will actually have resources as well to be able to direct you to your nearest organizations.
You know, on a larger issue, and I know that this is a large question, but when we talk about such delicate issues like this that are just hit so close to home of domestic violence and the need for it, at a larger level, are there things that we could be doing either in our communities or politically that could help us just to be able to stop this this cycle of abuse that you've observed in your work with so many different families?
Yes. So the number one thing I would say is to do what we're doing right now. It's to talk about it. To let people know they're not alone is a big part of it. To get involved in politics, to remind them, hey, this isn't an issue from the 70s or 80s. It's still very much prevalent today. How can we introduce legislation that will help? To have a conversation on a national level, to have a conversation in your communities, to have conversations with our friends. That's a huge part of just getting it out there and reminding people that it's still very much a prevalent social issue today.
I want to be sensitive to privacy, but I do want to ask this question. Could you share a story that you deem to be a success from someone who has worked with your organization?
Yeah, so we actually have had a person in the past that was a survivor that sought out our services for protective orders, that sought out our services for being an advocate in the courtroom, having someone there, somebody that knew that our shelter was available, that our crisis line was available, and they actually started volunteering for our organization. They got out of that relationship, moved on, and several years later now is working for our organization to spread the word so that other people can know all about it. And sometimes success looks different for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it takes about 7 times on average for someone to leave their abuser before they can successfully permanently leave.
Wow.
So really, if it's providing that safe place on time number 5 or time number 1, whatever it is, one step closer to them being safe and empowered and giving them hope, that is success to us.
That's awesome. And us is Wings of Hope, and you can find them online, wingsofhopeok.com. The OK is because they're in Stillwater, Oklahoma. We've been visiting with Casey Nichols. You can learn more by going to that website, wingsofhopeok.com. Or what's the website that you reference for the on the national level?
Yeah, so National Network to End Domestic Violence is thehotline.org. And you can find all sorts of resources. They also have resources in Spanish.
Oh, awesome. Casey, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Yes, thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
How can we express our opinions while keeping the conversation positive? That's coming up next. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Now, how can you feel great about yourself with simple, intuitive acts? Are there things that you could be doing that could help you stay healthy? Well, in 20 minutes, we're going to learn from an expert in that field. But first, it's time for your morning buzz with Lisa V. That's right. It's me. I'm taking over the morning buzz today and bringing you 3 things that you can talk to your family and friends about. As Richie says, over the water cooler, you know, topics that people are buzzing about. And now that we're going back to water cooler talk, these are some things that you can talk about. First of all, and maybe even most importantly, today is National Power Smile Day. And so what can you do to celebrate June 15th, National Smile Power Day? Well, smile. Because when you smile to someone, you're telling them hello and putting them off guard a little bit. Research has proven that smiling really does increase attractiveness and likability between humans. Smiling increases a greater trust and increased interpersonal cooperation. Smiling at someone can help them relax and relieve their stress, while at the same time, it'll make you feel at ease too. And even if you don't feel like it, smiling will lift your mood. It's science. It can make you a happier person. So, if you have a hard time smiling, well, think of a few happy moments that automatically generate a smile for you, or maybe make a list of things that you're grateful for. Keep that list handy if you have a hard time smiling, but you can celebrate National Smile Power Day. Also, on this day in history, June 15th, 1995. Today was the day that the famous statement came into our public consciousness. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. The prosecution in the Simpson murders asks O.J. Simpson to try on one of the gloves found at the murder scene of his home. Simpson appeared to have difficulty putting on the glove over the latex gloves he was wearing. And the prosecution claimed they believe the gloves shrank. They presented a witness that said that he had purchased these gloves. It became very famous. The gloves became a huge point of interest in this case. And the famous statement, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Football Hall of Fame running back O.J. Simpson was later found not guilty for the murders of ex-wife Nicole Brown and her friend Ronald Goldman. The trial, dubbed the trial of the century, we're still talking about it. That was this day in 1995. And finally, the biggest Google search for today is the power of the burrito. Shelby Houlihan, U.S. runners blame burritos for 4 years of ban on doping prior to the Tokyo Olympics. That's right. Shelby Houlihan, an American record holder at the 1500 and 5000 meters, has revealed that he's been banned for 4 years after a positive test that concludes that it is a contaminated pork burrito. Houlihan's announcement on his Instagram account on Monday arrives a few days before the start of the athletics at the U.S. Olympics in Eugene, Oregon. And the top three in each event will go when the spots for the postponed Tokyo tournament. Also, Houlihan said that she received an email as well. And she learned that the World Anti-Doping Agency, that's WADA, has long understood that eating pork can result in false positives for nandrolone. And it's because certain types of pigs naturally produce this in large quantities. So Shelby Houlihan has been banned from athletics for 4 years after failing that drug test. You know, I've eaten a lot of burritos in my life. I've had a lot of pork burritos. I have no regrets. But it hasn't ruined my career. And it hasn't postponed anything I wanted to do. It's really interesting because it we're going to have to look forward to now of what that will mean for the Olympics and what that will mean for other athletes and competing sports as well. And that is your morning buzz. Are you the aggressive one at the dinner table or the one who tends to keep their head down pretending not to hear the commotion?
Head well, down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I have to. Now, lucky for us, we get to talk to Emily Taylor about how to have healthy discussions despite the disagreements you might have with your great uncle Bob. Emily is a certified mediator, assistant director of the Center for Peace and Conflict Resolution at the BYU Law School. She's also the author of Raising Mediators, How Smart Parents Use Mediation to Transform Sibling Conflict and Empower Their Children. Thank you for being here, friend of the show, Emily.
Sir, it's great to be here.
Okay, so this, even approaching this conversation, I think can make people feel uncomfortable. They'd rather not talk about uncomfortable things or being in that situation. And so my hope for this discussion is for us to be able to acknowledge some of the traps that we sort of fall into and avoid them and have healthier, better, more positive interactions. So having That's said it. That, what is it that goes wrong in our political conversations with each other?
Well, I think there's a variety of things, but let me just note off a few. I think we often have political conversations when we're not ready to, or we approach we're caught off guard, or we open our social media and we see something that's really offensive and we react to it. So the timing of it and the emotion of it is something that we get wrong. We respond and we're often kind of put in a position when we're not prepared to have a conversation that is conflict ridden by its very nature. So that I would throw out is like the, we often get that wrong to begin with.
Well, so then this is great because we're having this conversation now. How can we best prepare to have political conversations?
Sure. I would say the first thing that we need to do is we need to take time for self-reflection. You don't want to be caught off guard with your opinion or be put on the spot and speak when you have a hot or high emotion. So take time for self-reflection and cool down first. Even buy time and saying, hey, that's a really important topic. I do have some thoughts on it, but I'd like to talk about this when I've had a little more time to reflect.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying that is okay.
Yeah.
You're not being a loser by avoiding the topic when you're not ready to have that conversation.
Is it just
so that would be the first.
Is it just a good practice to avoid these type of conversations either in text or on social media?
It depends. You'd have to have, so one of the other like next steps is to set ground rules for a conversation. There are people I have seen online and in social media set some pretty good ground rules for conversations and keep them. So one is to set boundaries, some rules, even online, saying, hey, this is not about one side or the other. I just want to know what you guys all think about climate change. And then everybody would weigh in on it. And if there were anyone who went across the line, then you could say, hey, and enforce that boundary. Say, hey, we're not talking about that. I'm going to delete any comments that, you know, go too far. So set ground rules. You don't always need to avoid these conversations, but if it's all about escalated emotion, you're probably not going to get very far.
So, you've mentioned emotion and getting overly emotional a couple of times. And so I want to take a look at that. Why is it that we tend to become over emotional when we're having disagreements? Why can't it just simply be a statement of fact?
Ooh, I guess in this climate, even what is determined to be facts are so different. I think what has become part of people's identities in the past, say conservative, liberal, you know, Democrat, Republican, has become primary in terms of people's identities. And at least from a conflict resolution perspective, anytime you attack someone's identity, they are likely to fight like crazy. You have to be aware and be in an environment where it's not just about your identity, but you're actually talking about the topic. And that's why you need some ground rules to say, hey, you know, I'd really like to understand the right to bear arms. I grew up in a certain place. This was kind of how people viewed things. And you're also needing to request permission to have a conversation that could be touchy instead of just forcing your way into it or throwing someone into a situation they're not prepared to handle. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So having that time to go back to that idea of preparing, to self-reflection, cool down, set those ground rules. Yes. And then when we're do we just talk about it? And does there need to be a moderator? I mean, really, I'm asking honestly. I know that sounds sort of funny.
No. I think probably a lot of us are asking the same thing. So I mean, we've seen these really hot and heated, you know, presidential debates or, you know, vice presidential. And we've seen even with having a moderator, things can be very difficult. So I don't think having a moderator is a bad idea. But I think so in one of the steps I did mention was requesting permission for a conversation. So I was recently at a big family gathering and it was a little late at night. So I don't think I would have had this conversation. I wasn't as prepared for a conversation, but one of my relatives just leaned over and, you know, asked me, hey, what do you think about X? And then everybody turned over to me. They knew I was the one that didn't have, you know, I had a dissimilar opinion about it. And it put me on the spot, but she did ask. And I could have just said, hey, I'd prefer to not have that conversation now, or could we have that just when it's you and I? But we're going to, you ask for the permission, but then if you are the one asking, you need to listen first. That's just a kind of a basic conversational tool, is if you're going to ask the question, you need to listen first instead of imposing what you think.
Sometimes in situations like this, there's a phrase that comes up here on the Lisa Show where we say something to the effect of know thyself. Is there an aspect of this that maybe you are just disagreeable, or maybe you just shouldn't participate in any of these conversations? Like you can just kind of turn that off or dismiss it?
For sure. So I've kind of hammered in this idea of any conflict you approach, you can avoid it, accommodate it, compromise with, compete, or collaborate. If you're going into a family gathering and every time your Uncle Bob brings up politics, it turns into a huge debate and the family kind of loses its connection, maybe don't get involved in that conversation with Bob. or even just say, hey, as a family, can we just, you know, put this on the back burner and just focus on, you know, sharing fun memories we've had of vacations past or whatever. But I think it's okay to say, I don't want to get into that conversation. I know that will trigger me, and I don't want to be triggered right now. I think that's know thyself, as you just said.
So did you end up stating your opinion, and how did it go?
I did. My defenses were down. It was a little bit late, and I just started sharing, and no one was particularly aggressive, but I did feel really put on the spot. Mm-hmm. So I would have preferred to have that conversation just with a person who asked me, but everybody else started getting quiet and turning to listen to me.
Yeah.
And I really didn't like that because I already knew that they kind of disagreed with me, and mm-hmm. they weren't critical, but it was just, I could tell, like, even when I cited some of my sources, that there was a little bit of the rolling of the eyes. Mm. So I would have preferred to have it separately. And think about that when you're going into big extended family situations in particular, or even a group of 5 to 6 people. Maybe that's a conversation that should just be one-on-one and not with a whole group of people, because you don't want to create sides.
Yeah.
A lot of times the group conversation will turn into us versus them.
Some,
me versus the rest.
Yeah, and some of that for me. I'm just laughing at my own personal situation. We're talking with Emily Taylor about how to disagree without being disagreeable. And for me, or as my wife would say, you're just not allowed in some rooms or some discussions. For the time being, for the foreseeable future, I am not allowed to be on social media after a certain time.
At night.
Yeah. At night.
I like that.
Because during the day, I'm pretty level-headed.
Happy.
You know, everyone is welcome, and I appreciate mm-hmm. the opinions of everyone.
Gracious.
But there is something very... I become a keyboard warrior is essentially what happens as we get to the evening time, and people will post things and I'll say, well, you're wrong because
and it's just not productive.
Yeah, it isn't. And I feel like it destroys not only relationships, but also good conversation that could exist. So for me and for my house, we have decided to just remove ourselves from these discussions.
I would like to kind of use the time that we have left to talk about how we can be like the leaders in creating a good conversation, not just where we feel comfortable, but that where other people feel comfortable to share how they really feel.
Sure. Okay. So there's some very definite steps. So I am also a moderator for a group called Braver Angels. They're a national group helping with civic dialogue, specifically about politics. Mm-hmm. So some of these steps I've borrowed from them, but you requested permission, and you are going to listen first. And you're going to listen and show that you're listening by doing a couple things. You actually want to understand. Most people have developed political opinions over a longer period of time than just a few weeks, mm-hmm. you know, or just an election cycle. So if you really want to know why they think what they think, you need to dig a little deeper. And if you can, get to the other person sharing some of their personal experiences, it may clarify their political view. Say, for example, someone was in an armed robbery when they were, you know, working at their part-time job. Mm-hmm. The right to bear arms may have a very different meaning to them than someone like me who grew up in, you know, very liberal town in Palo Alto, California, where maybe just I never saw people with guns and mm-hmm. it seemed foreign. So if you can, you're going to listen first. You're going to try to understand and elicit actual personal experiences, and you're going to summarize what you hear without any judgment added. No,
that's the hard part.
What you hear.
Don't eye roll. Got it.
No, yeah. No contempt.
No contempt at all. Really being able to restate what it is they're saying.
Yeah, you just simply say, so I hear you saying you're really concerned about taxes going up, and you want to make sure that whoever is in, you know, a federal leadership role is not going to do that and doesn't have a record of raising taxes, right? That's not saying, oh, you want another, like, you're not blaming or accusing. You're mm-hmm. just relaying what you hear. And especially if you're going to do that in a group, So if there are other people listening, they can hear it also. They're like, oh, that is what she just said. Okay, I'm good with that. And then you're not just listening. A lot of us who are trying to be good-hearted go in and we listen, and then we never get to share what we think.
Yeah.
So a conversation is sharing back and forth. So when you share your perspective, so you've restated what you heard the other person say, instead of saying, but, we often
yeah.
listen, and then we throw in the big but as if, okay, that's great you think that, but I'm really the enlightened one.
So, yeah, but I know more or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, instead of saying but, just say, hey, you know, I hear you saying this. I actually have kind of a different experience and perspective on it. Hmm. Do you mind if I share where I'm coming from?
That's really powerful because it is. The second that we say but, we say, yeah,
feel like somebody's not really listening to you.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, you're just waiting until you can throw in your words and kind of like show that the other person's wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
It can seem really obvious when we do that. So we have to train ourselves to do the listening first. And then when it's our turn, showing respect, but still, oh, I just said, but I'm going to think about it every time I say it.
I know.
that you have a legitimate perspective too. It's just different. And that you're sharing perspective.
Yeah.
And then you definitely don't want to stereotype. If you share your perspective and say, hey, unlike, you know, liberals, mm-hmm. I think this, as if that person across the table from you is just everything that stereotyped of a liberal is. These are unique individuals, and if you treat people as unique individuals, they will likely share more as a unique individual rather than just spouting off whatever their party or their platform mm-hmm. tells them they should say. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ending where we started, is it possible to disagree without being disagreeable?
It is possible, but I always tell people to have an exit strategy.
What's your exit strategy?
Sometimes just a little funny line like, well, we sure solved the world's problems there. Or, you know, hey, we tried our best, but, you know, maybe we're not going to agree today.
Mine is there pie?
Emily Taylor, a certified mediator, conflict coach, and assistant director of BYU Center for Peace and Conflict Resolution. She is an author, and you can find her on her website, raisingmediators.com, or on conflictfluent.com. Thanks for being with us, Emily.
Now, another really great thing to talk about with anyone is Lisa's Adventure Club, right? This is a great conversation starter. You won't be disagreeable at all. Simply go to byuradio.org/adventure to enter for a chance to win. I got a little excited there. An annual National Parks Pass. You know, we're giving away here on the Lisa Show one of these family passes every week all summer long. You can enter for a chance to win. What was I getting so excited about? Well, okay, so right now I'm going to give you a secret word that will give you an additional entry, an additional opportunity and chance to win. Today, this week, right now, today's secret word is boots. Boots. Because you're going to need some good boots if you're going to go out hiking. So this is going to give you an extra entry. So go over, again, byuradio.org/adventure. That's our website. Enter for a chance to win that annual National Parks Pass. Now, at the end of the summer, after we've given away so many of these every week, annual National Parks Pass, we're going to have a grand prize where you can earn that pass as well as a $500 Visa card. So there are chances to win all summer long. I'm really rooting for you because this is a great opportunity to get out, have an adventure, grab your family, go to a national park that you've always wanted to go to, somewhere you've never been before, Lisa's Adventure Club. Now, coming up next, are you working with or against your body by the things that you do every day? Well, we're going to help you with biohacks. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Our bodies are amazing. We have like very complex systems that work most of the time to help us get through the day, but sometimes we end up working against our bodies. I think anecdotally, haven't you always heard where people are saying, oh, I've tricked my body into running my metabolism better, or my body wants to eat all of this ice cream, but I've tricked it into liking vegetables or having them taste a little bit sweeter. There's so many different things that we can do that can change the way that we view our bodies. And today we're going to be hearing from someone who is going to help us not just work with, but hack into the needs of our bodies. Here with us in this conversation is Dr. Julia Jones, aka Dr. Rock. She's refined the science of biohacking and is here to tell us really what that means. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Jones.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for inviting me.
So biohacking sounds, I think when you first hear it, something straight out of like a Terminator movie. Does it have anything to do with artificial intelligence? Are we changing our bodies and trying to systemize them?
Well, I mean, it's a new term, but the underlying principles are not new at all. I first was introduced to them in the early 1990s, the elite military and elite sports participants have been using these practices for decades. But now it's kind of gained the trendy term of biohacking. And it really means mm-hmm. is if you think of life hacks, so clever little techniques and tricks of how best to peel an orange or how to most efficiently fold a shirt or something like that, you know, those kind of little life hacks that make things easier. And a biohack is the same sort of thing. It's something that is very efficient but targeting our biology. So it's, you know, how to tap into our circadian circuits in our brain to help our sleep, how to tap into our breathing rhythms to help reduce our stress. So that's all it is, really. It's kind of an efficient little trick or technique. And sometimes the technology is available now, and artificial intelligence, you mentioned that then, but mm-hmm. some of the devices now and the wearables are helping us able to tap into our biology like that to keep us well.
I think all of us would be really attracted to the idea of being able to tap into our biology to gain some of the same benefits as some of these elite, you know, athletes and specialists. So what are some biohacks that you feel like anyone could benefit from?
So, well, firstly, I totally agree that everyone wants to, you know, why should these benefits just be enjoyed by elite athletes and elite military? It's
right.
Fascinating
mm-hmm.
that this science is, you know, this is not new stuff, but it just has not seeped into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone, you know, you don't have to be Usain Bolt to benefit from these things. We've all got the same biology, the basic evolutionary circuits. So some of my favorite ones are, my book is based on the experiment I did last year. So mm-hmm. I did 12 months of cancelling my gym membership and just doing these techniques, which I refer to as smart wellness. So the first ones I do is make my bed, which is really simple. But when you make your bed really well, it's a really nice way to kickstart some positive brain chemicals and set you up for a good day. And after that, I go outside and get natural light into my eyes, because the cells at the back of our retina are wired into the neurons in our brain that dictate the release of melatonin later that day. So when you get early daylight into your eyes, it tells the brain that it's morning, and so it knows that to inhibit the release of melatonin until sort of, you know, 12 to 14 hours later when it's time for us to get sleepy. And we used to live outdoors. You know, we're living in a very weird environment now that our brain has evolved over a very long time, and suddenly it's surrounded by things that it doesn't understand. So our brain can't determine, well, there's a bright light above my head, so it must be the sun. But at night, no, it's a light bulb, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's telling our brain it's daytime when it's nighttime and we should be getting sleepy. So things like going outside early for daylight are really super powerful ways of of helping to improve your sleep quality, and then trying not to disrupt it in the evening by using bright overhead lights. So in the evening, I switch to low-level dimmer switches or table lamps instead of ceiling lights. So I'm trying not to confuse the brain. And this mm-hmm. is an easy habit, Lisa. I used to let my dog out in the morning mm-hmm. and stand in the doorway and wait for him to come back in.
Sure.
And the only change I've made is that instead of doing that, I now walk out into the garden with him.
Wow. Okay,
that,
so...
Honestly, my sleep's supercharged uh-huh. just doing these small things.
This is so interesting. So it was a 12-month experiment where you know, I've heard make your bed, go outside in that natural light, and let your eyes really signal to your brain that you're outside, that it's not artificial. And then in the evening, you lowered the level of lights. Is there anything else that I'm missing?
Well, if you are someone who tends to use your screens late at night, mm-hmm. then I use blue light blocker glasses mm-hmm. if I'm using screens in the evening, because the blue light, the spectrum of light in the morning has a lot of blue light in it, but as it goes towards sunset, the light changes and it becomes more of a red light and less of a blue light. But our screens emit blue light. So if you use your screens at night, you're kind of signaling to your brain that it's morning, because morning light has got blue light in it.
Mm-hmm.
So blue light blocker glasses now are quite affordable and easily available. And if I'm using screens at night, I wear blue light blocker glasses so I don't, you know, confuse those circuits with the light.
So after you tried this experiment for 12 months, what were the results that you found?
Staggering results, Lisa. I've been looking at this science for 30 years, and even I can't believe
really
how much of a difference this made. Honestly, I'm now in my 50s. Mm-hmm. I'm back to the weight that I was in my 20s, and exercise didn't do that. And I'm a seasoned sport and exercise scientist, so it's not that I wasn't doing the right thing.
Sure.
It's because our lifestyles. There's a reason that 5 decades of diet and fitness trends didn't produce healthy nations. You know, that a lot of that stuff is not aligned with our biology, and you can't exercise off of poor nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
You have to start at, well, okay, well, you know, I'm eating too much. I'm eating at the wrong time of day, because we all are. That's the lifestyle we now have. And I pushed my breakfast back later in the morning. So instead of having it at 6-7 o'clock when I got up, I pushed it back to 11, which is known as intermittent fasting.
Mm-hmm.
And it just basically means that you eat within an 8 to 10 hour window in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So your body has time to go into a fasted state. And it's, you know, we should be doing that, because that's, our ancient ancestors didn't eat all the time like we do. We've become mm-hmm. overeaters and constant eaters, eating late at night, early in the morning, and our body never gets into that fasted state, because it's always digesting food that we're putting inside us. And that's very, very bad for our internal inflammation levels.
Now, Dr. Jones, you're the founder of Neuron Smart Wellness, and you've spent a lifetime studying and applying this neuroscience and cognitive psychology and behavioral science to develop this methodology behind biohacking. And I appreciate you explaining what you did and for 12 months and how it positively benefited your life. And earlier you mentioned that this is not really seeped into mainstream, and I'm wondering if it's because it seems like just good advice, right? Like it, because this sort of advice has been around for a while, that we might easily dismiss it, even though it's backed by science.
Because it sounds too easy.
It does. And I'm wondering, why? Before you went into this experience, what did you think was going to happen? And what were sort of the hesitancies you had that maybe other people have when they sound, I don't know, this sounds too easy.
So I've been, you know, for 30 years, I've been telling people to join gyms and do exercise and do that, you know, the fitness
sure.
and the focus. And it clear, even by the end of the 90s, we could see that it wasn't working. But that kind of narrative has really been hammered into our psyche. You know, it's like you must go and, you know, the answer is do more exercise. And actually, we need to do a very, very small amount of physical movement every day for wellness. And that's the difference here, is that I realize that I don't need fitness. I need wellness. And wellness and fitness are different things. Fitness was based on a model of elite sport. So if you want to keep increasing your scores and improving your scores, or enter a 10K race, or build muscle, or, you know, do something like that, you need you need fitness, right? If you just want to avoid illness, which is what I'm looking for, I don't want to be ill, then you just need wellness, which is, you know, whenever you're not ill, you're well. And that, for that, you need good sleep, good low levels of stress, moderate amounts of movement, the ability to be able to slow down your brain waves so that you can get into a resting period so that you're not just full out burning out constantly, looking at how to maintain inflammation levels by not, you know, overeating, eating tons of fruit and vegetables, because we have been designed over such a long time from an evolutionary point of view to eat plant-based things, and now we're eating processed weird inventions that we thought we were very clever creating all these things, but they're killing us. You know, that's the reality of it. And when you look at all these bits, the habits, you know, there's about 30 habits that I did that are now my normal daytime routine, and they take, you know, minutes. I don't even think about it now, but it seems too easy because we have been brought up to think that we have to sweat. No pain, no gain, right?
Yeah.
That kind of like, and it's just not like that. That's not how you help your ancient biology just work well. We have inbuilt systems that can keep us well if we get out of their way. And we are interfering with them constantly with our modern inventions that were designed to kind of help make life easier. But what they've actually done is just disrupt those natural biological processes from working properly. So this smart wellness approach is about understanding your biology. So learning a bit about how your body and your brain works, doing smart little hacks and techniques like going out early for daylight or having late breakfast or something like that. And then using smart tech wearables so that you can monitor the effect. So, you know, a watch or a ring or any kind of wearable that gives you a bit of information about your sleep quality, about your number of steps you're doing in a day, the movement, you know, basic information so that you can look at this stuff. A gut microbiome test as well. I thought, you know, anyone, before I started this experiment, anyone would have said about me that I was super healthy.
Okay.
And because I wasn't, you know, overweight. I'd been putting on a pound a year for 15 years. So I was definitely, that's how most of us end up in the overweight and obese category, because it happens silently over over a long time and it creeps up on you. But my gut microbiome test was terrible. I was shocked.
Really?
I scored 4 out of 10. Because I was, even though I was eating, you know, what I thought was quite a lot of fruit and veg, it wasn't nearly enough. I was drinking dairy products, and it turns out that was causing inflammation, because I don't have the bacteria to be able to digest lactose, gluten. You know, it was just terrible. And I've just had my retest back. And I've gone from scoring 4 out of 10 to 9 out of 10.
Wow. Oh, that's a drastic change.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, when you talk about these 30 different habits that are now your daytime routine, was there one that was particularly difficult to implement for you? And how did you get over that sort of hump in order to do it to get the benefits?
Well, the hardest one for me was getting into the routine of embedding strength work. So the other kind of physical activity I found easy. You know, not going to the gym didn't matter because I moved my printer upstairs. So during the day, I had to keep going upstairs to get the paper. And I have a dog. So every day I was walking. So that was quite easy. But when I stopped going to the gym, I still needed to do strength work because our muscle tissue is a part of our immune system. It plays, we now know, you know, over the past kind of decade, it's become really apparent that our muscles, it's not about just about strength, it's about the chemical cascades that come out of our muscle tissue that are part of our immunity, part of our immune system. So it's important to do strength work. So I was doing slow motion push-ups just for a few minutes, a couple of days a week, and I found that quite difficult to embed because I associated that kind of activity with the gym. I habit stacked it with another habit. So I did it when my coffee was brewing.
Nice.
So I always make coffee. So every morning I have coffee. I push my breakfast back, but I still had coffee early in the morning because that doesn't break the fast. So so while the coffee was percolating, I did the slow motion push-ups then, and that's how I managed to then embed that.
I love it. It's like habit stacking with biohacking, using what we know from neuroscience and cognitive psychology, behavioral science, to set ourselves up for success. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Jones.
Thanks very much. Lovely speaking with you.
If people want to find out more about your work, your experiment, and your research, where can they go?
My website is drjuliajones.com. And the book is called Neuron Smart Wellness.
Thank you again.
It's not. It's called Neuron Smart Wellness Made Easy.
Got it. I love it. Thank you so much for this great conversation.
Thank you very much.
You bet. So don't forget to go to Lisa's Adventure Club. You can go to byuradio.org/adventure. This week's secret word, boots, for an extra entry to a chance to win that annual National Parks Pass. Get some adventure for you and your family. Don't hesitate. Do that now. We're giving away one every week this summer. Now, coming up next, do you have a life motto? Do you need one? Well, life mottos and what they can do for this, that's coming up next.
The Lisa Show is happening now.
Happening now.
With Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. It's The Lisa Show.
Do you ever get frustrated when you feel like someone isn't really listening to you? Coming up in 20 minutes, join us as we learn about the importance of honest listening. And then in 15 minutes in your morning buzz, how a burrito is messing up the Tokyo Olympics. Here on this show, we're always trying to save you time and maybe a little bit of money, save you a little heartache, find those sort of tips and tricks and hacks to share them like we once did in sort of a town square. But because we're also spread out in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our families, it's kind of a nice way, or at least this is the way that I like to see the show, to help in a practical way. And I don't know anyone who is more full of good ideas and practical than my sister Gina and friend of the show, Gina James. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for saying that. That's very nice.
Well, so it's true. And so the question that I am throwing out to everyone, and we would love to hear from you if you want to email thelisashow@byu.edu with those kinds of tips and tricks that have saved you heartache in your life. You know, those kinds of systems maybe even that you've implemented in your own life that maybe you even take for granted now that you realize, oh, yeah, I do this thing and it actually makes my life a lot easier. Share them with us, thelisashow@byu.edu. So I want to dive into that. And I want to give Gina, and I want to put her on the spot right now and give her a challenge of giving us three simple ideas that if everyone followed, okay, that it would make their life better. And I'm going to give you an example so that you can be ready to go. We've done shows and done interviews where somebody will say, and it was like this army general, and he wrote a book about it, about like, if you make your bed every day, it has a great impact on your life. And here's why. And a lot of news outlets picked it up, and it was a hot topic for a while. Another sort of hack that seems to come up and is certainly been popular lately is if you go to bed an hour earlier and wake up an hour earlier, you will be more productive. And here's why. And then there's like science behind it and things like that. And I feel like you can really not only get to know somebody really well, but also collect and sort of pick and choose what you might be looking for to make your life a little bit better by sharing ideas. And so that's what we're trying to do today. Gina, what are three simple things, an idea, a hack, a tip, a trick that you feel if everyone did it, it would make their lives a little bit better or a little easier?
Okay. I've got my number one tip. Keep the car stocked with stuff that you regularly need or get asked for. Okay.
Okay.
For example, when I leave the house, and this is particularly for those with children, when I leave the house and we're going for an extended little errand run or a short hike or something, mm-hmm. always pack more water than you think you need.
Oh,
always.
Okay.
Always take water. If I'm going to run errands, I fill up a huge water bottle of water and bring an extra one, because inevitably someone is going to say, I'm really thirsty, and save yourself, a dollar driving through to go get a drink or something. Just have water in the car. That sounds really simple.
No, but it's like a basic human need.
Everybody,
need water.
People are going to get thirsty. They're not going to get a drink of water before you
do
leave
you
the house.
Do you keep bottled water in your car?
I do sometimes, but usually I just fill up a huge, water bottle, mm-hmm. just a reusable water bottle. Another thing I always keep in my car is a tube of chapstick, plain chapstick, because my children, my husband, everyone inevitably gets dry lips. And we live in a dry climate.
I'm only laughing
because chapstick.
Somebody always needs chapstick. Not
yes.
lipstick, because I always have
no.
lipstick.
Well, that's
But chapstick,
me.
And I never have it.
You never have it. So the greatest
thing.
I've
never thought of that.
My dentist's office gives away chapstick. And so we have like a million of them. And I keep them in my car. I keep one in the kitchen. Like, they're all over, so that if somebody needs a chapstick and I don't let them take it out of the car, like, this is the car chapstick. Anyway, chapstick and tissues napkins. Always keep them in the glove box.
What about wet wipes?
I've moved on from wet wipes because I figure you can take the water and dampen the napkin if you're really desperate. But also in the glove box, I will keep some snacks sometimes. Non-melting, no chocolate. Learn that lesson. Maybe stay away from even granola bars that have like chocolate in them or on them.
Yeah.
But just a little snack, like nuts and dried fruit. Sometimes I'll keep like some trail mix in there because somebody's always hungry. You're thirsty. You're always hungry. So I just kind of keep the car stocked with some of those things.
Okay. That's a great tip. Okay. Tip number two, to make your life better.
This is something that I've just discovered recently, but I try to fold the clothes as they come out of the dryer.
Okay, why?
Now, I know because inevitably somebody will need, well, number one reason, I don't want wrinkly t-shirts. Mm-hmm. And if you let it sit or sit in the bottom of a basket, inevitably it gets crushed and wrinkly. Second of all, it's really satisfying that when the laundry's done, it's done.
Oh,
you don't
yeah.
have to throw it on a bed and sort it out and do it. I sort as I go. And this is where maybe like make your kids do more laundry, but but I like doing it because then it's folded and then it gets put away.
Yeah,
for some reason, if my
anything.
Kids have to sort it and then put it away, it doesn't get done as well. But if it's folded and presented to them like, here's your pile of laundry, put it away, then they will put it away. But I like to do it because then it helps me stay on top of it, on top of the laundry, because it's usually multiple loads at once. And it's easier to fit it into what I'm doing around. I rarely, No one sits down and puts wash in, then waits for it to gather dry. Then, you know, it's always it's kind of an in-between thing. Yeah.
And everyone's always overwhelmed by laundry. So if you can focus on this one thing of
just do a little bit at a time, then I think it just makes it super manageable.
Have you always done this?
No. I've just done this in the last like 3 or 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which takes like sometimes it is kind of a pain because I'm standing in front of the dryer folding and sorting at the same time. But I have like I've gotten a lot of baskets now. And so I have a really small laundry room. So it's not like convenient at all. But I'd rather just handle it in there than take it out and have it anywhere else in the house. I just want to contain.
Yeah, you just want to get it done with.
Yeah, I just want to be done.
If you're just jumping into the conversation, we're talking to a friend of the show who happens to be my little sister, Gina James, about three simple ideas that if everyone followed, their life would be better. You know, sharing good ideas is an important part of not only improving your life, but paying it forward, right? Because sometimes these things are hard won. And when we hear it from someone who has tried it out and tried out the other way, it is a huge benefit for us. So if you're listening and thinking, oh yeah, no, I have this thing, you've got to do this, email thelisashow@byu.edu. In the subject heading, put simple task to improve your life or do this. And we're going to read it. And we'd love to be able to share it on the show. Okay, so keep water and snacks in the car.
And chapstick.
And chapstick, because you will always need it.
Yes.
And tissues.
And tissues.
Like, keep your car stocked. That was the simple advice. Just keep it stocked because you're going to run errands. You could be, I don't know, caught in the snowdrift. I mean, you didn't even talk about like an emergency situation, but you'd need all those things, right? But don't store chocolate.
You've don't store chocolate.
But every other treat is on it. Your second tip was to fold the laundry as soon as it comes out of the dryer.
I know it's hard. It's a pain. It takes a little hurdle to start doing. But once you start doing it, I think you'll be surprised.
Because it seems like it has a sort of a dominoes effect, right? Because then if it's folded, it gives you a boost. Then it's in a basket. So that's another, you don't have to put it from, you know, the floor of your bed to the basket. So that step's already taken care of, and it makes people more likely to put it away, and you don't have to iron.
Yeah, it really saves on the t-shirts.
Because it's going to save you a lot of time.
Well, I was going to say, most of our clothes now, we don't iron so much. And so if you do it right as it's still slightly warm, then it will stay nice. And anyway.
What's your third tip?
Okay. My third tip, and this, it's controversial. You guys.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Okay, because you're the one who said go to bed an hour early. Well, guess what? That's not going to happen at my house.
Right. Well, you know, it's not going to happen either, but it's a great idea. Maybe somebody will do it.
But I really like the idea of straightening up. Now, this isn't a full clean. It's just to straighten up the house before you go to bed.
Okay, now why is this going to be controversial? Because we're weird people.
Well,
we like this.
No, it's not controversial to you, but a lot of people are like, no, you just go to bed.
Yeah, it'll be there in the morning.
It'll be
Who
there
cares?
In the morning. I'll take care of it in the morning. Well, guess what?
What?
When you wake up and there's no dishes in the sink and all the pillows are on your couch, I mean, like that is
floor.
A really small thing. I have a dog who likes to jump up. We didn't train him well. I'll fully admit that. He jumps up on the living room couches and often knocks down my lovely decorative pillows.
Oh, no,
and
not the decorative pillows.
I know. Well, they're lovely. They just add that panache to your couch that you need.
Right.
Anyway, so he'll jump off the couch from where he's been barking at everybody that walks by and knock down the pillows. And I swear, that is a job that I've given my child who wanted the dog in the first place.
Oh, that's another story.
That's a whole other story. Don't get a dog. I love him, but seriously, dogs. But I'm like, you know what? I just want the cushion straight on the couch. Like, that's just a simple thing.
Is that too much to ask?
Is that too... And the answer is no, because I ask it all the time.
So straighten up before you go to bed.
Straighten up.
And be honest. How long does it take you to do this?
It will take about 15 minutes. And I'm talking like just first level, so that if somebody comes over first thing in the morning, which
they won't,
they don't. But when I come downstairs in the morning and just seeing, and this is what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So at least in my house, there's just a living room and then a little dining area and then the kitchen and then a little family room off to the side. So I just make sure that the cushions are up on the couch any blankets, if people were using blankets to watch mm-hmm. in the family room, go inside a little cubby that we have in the ottoman. It has a storage space in it. There's no dishes in the sink. So we try to wash the dishes and wipe off counters.
Yeah.
So help me if there are crumbs in the morning when I'm making breakfast. Because I
what
have
happens?
Teenagers.
I know, but what happens?
That will come home and be like, oh, I want toast.
They always want toast and cereal.
At like 11:30 at night. Mm-hmm. And then they leave their crumbs and the toaster out. Now, granted, I may be taking out the toaster in the morning. But I just like it to be, I just want to start with a clean slate.
Well, I feel like it gives you a chance to take a deep breath and start the day like ahead instead of behind.
That's
right.
It makes
you feel that way. You don't have to wake up and go, oh, I got to clean the kitchen. It's like, no, I got a lot of stuff to do today, but at least this is done.
Yeah. I ate dinner last night. I don't want reminders of the dishes I used to make the dinner that I ate the night before.
Three simple ways that will improve your life. We have time. Do you have a bonus one or anything else that comes to mind? If not, it's okay. I just want to put you on the spot.
Now, a bonus one is to keep, and this is, I think I learned this from you actually.
Oh, I like this.
So is to keep the cleaning supplies mm-hmm. in the room with which you will use them.
Oh, yeah.
So
I do that.
Yeah. I think you told me. So in my bathrooms, there's a little thing of wipes, there's a little toilet bowl cleaner, and there's a scrub brush in each of the bathrooms. Mm-hmm. So that you don't have to get the one cleaning tub and take it everywhere. You can just...
So if you see a little spill, you can go, oh, I'm just going to get this real quick, and then it's done.
And some paper towels, I'm just going to wipe this up. Yeah, just keep it convenient. Make it really easy for your children to clean. Oh, do you see that? Well, just grab the wipes and wipe that down.
I love how we both laughed. It's the intention, right? We want that to be like the default that they go to if they, you know, they see it. Even if they don't do it, maybe it will inspire them in the future.
Well,
hope springs eternal.
That's right. And I think if we're showing the example, like picking up at night, then hopefully when we go visit our children in the future, their houses will be pleasant and clean to come to.
You couldn't even get it out without laughing.
I know. It's going to depend on the kid. But some of those lessons are sinking in.
Yes.
Some of them are.
And good intentions, and it's good. And here at the end of the day, you just have to live the way that you want to live.
Right.
And we all want to do things a little bit faster, a little bit more simplified, and to not worry about them, those things that we have to do every day. So thank you for sharing those sort of three simple ideas that if everyone followed, it would make your life a little bit easier. You could consider implementing some of them, maybe not all of them, but it's definitely worth a pause. And if you have a really great idea of things that you do that have saved you time and money, email thelisashow@byu.edu. Now, how does listening to those with depression actually help? That's coming up next. And why is a pork burrito so important to the Tokyo Olympics? That's coming up in your Morning Buzz. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Now, don't forget to enter for a chance to win an annual National Parks Pass at byuradio.org/adventure as part of Lisa's Adventure Club. Now, coming up, are you interested in pop culture? In 20 minutes, we're going to learn about a television historian whose job revolves around it. But first, it's time for your Morning Buzz with Lisa V. That's right. It's me. I'm taking over the Morning Buzz today and bringing you three things that you can talk to your family and friends about. As Richie says, over the water cooler, you know, topics that people are buzzing about. And now that we're going back to water cooler talk, these are some things that you can talk about. First of all, and maybe even most importantly, today is National Power Smile Day. And so what can you do to celebrate June 15th, National Smile Power Day? Well, smile, because when you smile to someone, you're telling them hello and putting them off guard a little bit. Research has proven that smiling really does increase attractiveness and likability between humans. Smiling increases a greater trust and increased interpersonal cooperation. Smiling at someone can help them relax and relieve their stress, while at the same time, it'll make you feel at ease too. And even if you don't feel like it, Smiling will lift your mood. It's science. It can make you a happier person. So if you have a hard time smiling, well, think of a few happy moments that automatically generate a smile for you, or maybe make a list of things that you're grateful for. Keep that list handy if you have a hard time smiling, but you can celebrate National Smile Power Day. Also, on this day in history, June 15th, 1995, today was the day that the famous statement came into our public consciousness, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit." The prosecution in the Simpson murders asked O.J. Simpson to try on one of the gloves found at the murder scene of his home. Simpson appeared to have difficulty putting on the glove over the latex gloves he was wearing. And the prosecution claimed they believe the glove shrank. They presented a witness that said that he had purchased these gloves. It became very famous. The gloves became a huge point of interest in this case. And the famous statement, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit." Football Hall of Fame running back O.J. Simpson was later found not guilty for the murders of ex-wife Nicole Brown and her friend Ronald Goldman. The trial, dubbed the Trial of the Century, we're still talking about it. That was this day in 1995. And finally, the biggest Google search for today is the power of the burrito. Shelby Houlihan, U.S. runners blame burritos for 4 years of ban on doping prior to the Tokyo Olympics. That's right. Shelby Houlihan, an American record holder at the 1500 and 5000 meters, has revealed that he's been banned for 4 years after a positive test that concludes that it is a contaminated pork burrito. Houlihan's announcement on his Instagram account on Monday arrives a few days before the start of the athletics at the U.S. Olympics in Eugene, Oregon. And the top three in each event will go win the spots for the postponed Tokyo tournament. Also, Houlihan said that she received an email as well. And she learned that the World Anti-Doping Agency, that's WADA, has long understood that eating pork can result in false positives for nandrolone. And it's because certain types of pigs naturally produce this in large quantities. So Shelby Houlihan has been banned from athletics for 4 years after failing that drug test. You know, I've eaten a lot of burritos in my life. I've had a lot of pork burritos. I have no regrets. But it hasn't ruined my career. And it hasn't postponed anything I wanted to do. It's really interesting because we're going to have to look forward to now of what that will mean for the Olympics and what that will mean for other athletes and competing sports as well. And that is your morning buzz. Alaska is one of the prettiest nature states in the United States. Each summer, nearly 200,000 people venture out to see the last of the western frontier and enjoy the endless summer days. However, in the winter, the never-ending winter nights and long open spaces can be deadly for those native to Alaska. Suicide is the leading cause of death for youth over the age of 15 and the sixth leading cause of death for all adults. One organization has set out to counter the effects of long cold winters by using the old healing art of listening. The Listening Post is an organization dedicated to listening Alaska's most vulnerable without judging, advising, counseling, suggesting, or cheerleading. Here to tell us more about their organization is Demi Sis and Avenue Waters, the organization's founding volunteers. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you.
And welcome, Avenue.
Thank you.
So the mission of Listening Post, help us understand. Avenue, let's start with you.
The mission really is to just listen. And we mean something very specific by that. We listen to the heart and soul of the individual with respect, with love, with compassion, and no judgment whatsoever. So we accept the person exactly as they are in that moment. So there's no, there's no reflection on their history mm-hmm. or what they might do tomorrow. It's right in the moment, respect and acceptance of who they are. And that is very healing.
So, Debbie, how did the Listening Post get started?
We had two spiritual directors that visited a listening post in Canada and came back and wanted to start one here in Anchorage. So we started in September of 2008 with a few volunteers, and we just kind of have always trusted the flow that where we're to go next, a site that we're going to open. We were just in one site, and now we're in up to eight sites, at least before the pandemic. So we just all got together, and it just goes as naturally and organically as it possibly could. We sign up on a schedule, and we show up, and it just works.
So when you say you just you sign up on a schedule and show up, Avenue, is it like at a restaurant? Is it at a community center? Is it that you all show up online together? What does it mean that you show up and listen?
So we actually do show up online, and we have a schedule so that our guests can find us. Our schedule is posted on our website. But we actually try to listen in pairs, and we listen online on Wednesdays. And we listened before the pandemic, like Debbie mentioned. We listened at several libraries. We listened at a medical center. We listened at the animal shelter. We used to listen at the downtown transit center. That was our first location. We listened at the Brother Francis homeless shelter. I'm probably missing something, but we do have specific sites where the vulnerable people and the general public, like the library, the big everybody. So we do intend to listen to anyone who needs a listening heart.
Well, and you also, it's very specific to teach your volunteer listeners to not advise or give any counsel or even make suggestions. That seems really difficult, especially when someone is calling who's in such distress. I'd love to understand a little bit more about why that is such an important part of what you do, and how that's even possible to help someone by just listening. What's your perspective?
Well, for me, this is Debbie. I feel that, and it's the listening post view, that we listen with an open heart without judgment or giving advice so that they feel free to come to us with their following story. So if we cheerlead and say, good for you, or that's wonderful, congratulations, and then something happens in their life that becomes that challenge resurfaces, whether it's an addiction or losing a job or anything, they may be hesitant to share their story, their follow-up story with us, for fear that they're letting us down or that they're feeling shamed. So we feel that we don't know them nearly as well as they know themselves, but by processing and just sharing their story, their own clarity comes to the surface.
Is there anything additional that you would add to that, Avenue?
Yeah, you know, there's everything that Debbie just mentioned. I mean, we do practice it as volunteer listeners. We meet monthly, and we do listening practices. So those human tendencies, or I would even say modern tendencies to fix, to advise, I'm not sure that that's our natural state of being. So we kind of unlearn as a group of committed volunteers that fix-it mentality. And there's something very interesting that does happen. I'll speak to the listener part of the question is to watch ourselves in that moment that we might naturally go, hey, did you ever think of trying such and such? Mm-hmm. Or, oh, that happened to me, and what I did was blah, blah, blah. Like, to catch yourself. And if you practice it, you really get quicker at catching that tendency. And something very amazing happens when you don't interrupt or interject. Let's say there's a pause in the other person's story, and instead of interjecting your opinion or your suggestion or advice, if you just wait, and the person, I mean, try it really, because the person probably will start to speak again about their story. They didn't actually need advice. And we may not know that. I might ask for advice not trusting myself, but really given the chance, we do know, each of us,
inside. It may be buried, but we know what's, I would say, best for us. That sounds kind of like, I don't know, two rose-colored glasses, but we really are the only ones who can make decisions for ourselves.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're talking with Avenue Waters and Debbie Siss from The Listening Post, an organization that, as you probably guessed by the name, focuses on listening, not on cheerleading, not on advising or counseling, but just providing that opportunity to be heard, to listen, and to speak with another individual. I would be curious, when we talk about having these conversations, is there a hesitation on behalf of those who would come to the Listening Post because our society is so much of like a fix-it society that they're hesitant that they're going to be judged or that there would be some sort of advice, counsel, cheerleading that they're hesitant to even engage at the beginning?
I have a funny story about that because especially when we were in our downtown location where people could walk through our door, we had like a storefront and inside there was several different like living room sort of pods. There's no walls between them, but little sections, right? So where maybe three people could be in there at the same time sitting with a volunteer and being heard. So at the door, someone would come up to the door and they'd go, you know, what is this? Mm-hmm. And we would say, you can come in here and we'll listen. You can sit quietly, but if you want a listener, we're available. And people would go, I mean, this happened so many times. Oh, I would never share my story. And I would still say, well, why don't you just come on in? And honestly, before they even sat down, they would start pouring their heart out. So the lack of trust or the suspicion or can I trust this person is probably there at the surface. But I really have experienced that deep down, we all want to be heard and known. So when someone, a volunteer listener, really is present, trust ends up, I don't know, surfacing. And I have seen it over and over and over.
You know, it's interesting when we talk about listening, I think we all bring, you know, our past experience to us when we move forward and we think, you know, in a situation of crisis, certainly we want to do the right thing. I'm wondering how you handle it when you're listening to someone in a very difficult story and in an impossible situation. You must struggle with wanting to go a step further, either during the conversation or maybe just immediately after. In those sorts of situations, what do you do? Debbie, let's start with you.
It does come up often because we a lot of times are listening to vulnerable communities where they do have very real and challenging situations at hand. So we're taught also that we don't attach to the outcome. It would be easy for me to say, well, why don't you try this or why don't you try that? Or when they leave, go home and think about it and wonder like, oh, I hope they're safe. I hope they're not on the street, and have it kind of haunt us. But we would not be able to serve if we attach to that. This is about their journey. We are honored to be able to sit with them and be present with a heart connection and listen. And we listen from heart to heart, but we don't absorb their story. We honor their story and we respect it. And, you know, when they leave and walk away, I often will just wish them well in my heart, in my own mind. And kind of then that's a break. If we were to give advice, or sometimes it would seem obvious, like, why don't you just try, mm-hmm. whatever. If we tried to do that, we would actually be interrupting their process. You know, we're not them. This is their journey. So to be present really means not to give advice. It's to be present and listen and allow them their own experience without making their experience our experience.
Did you have anything to add to that, Avenue?
Yeah, you know, all of this can be so nuanced that if we're thinking about just listening to someone who might be in a crisis, if we're
if we're sitting alone in our house, we think, we go, oh, that would never work. They, of course, need someone in crisis, would need intervention. There is something that happens in the reality of two people sitting together where non-judgment and compassion are genuinely being offered. There's a different kind of help. And there is this sense that the listening post does exist in a community. So if someone does need a meal or a place to sleep, there are other agencies that actually offer that. A lot of times they don't have the time to listen. You know, you're online, you get your soup and your sandwich, and the next person is online to get their food. And so that staff doesn't have the time to listen. So we do know that we live in a community. We work in a community. So if someone needs other services, they can get it. So when they come to us, there really is the freedom to just listen. Mm-hmm. And if you've experienced any hardship in your own life, and we all have, if someone offers you a listening ear, even though you might need something critical, there can be such a softening of both hearts, listener and guest, that it does help. It actually helps. You still might have to go off and get some service somewhere else, but to have someone that will just listen in your most hardest time really is a form of service. So the temptation to do more than listen, it might come up, but there's a confidence that if we just listen, it is not offered anywhere else, so we can keep to our mission.
A tremendous service that you guys are giving to folks. And one of the things that I love, too, is that sometimes when we think about helping others out or serving others, we think, oh, it's going to, you know, it costs so much money. I don't have money. I'm barely making it myself. But being able to listen is something that we can all do. Sure, it may take some learning, some guided skill, but but it's something that we can all do to help one another out. The Listening Post is an organization that offers compassionate listening. They do this at various places up in Alaska. They focus on listening to members of their city's most vulnerable community. If you would like to learn more about the Listening Post there in Anchorage, you can go to listeningpostanchorage.com. And we've been joined by Avenue Waters and Debbie Siss. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. Now, are you looking for a reason, an excuse to get out and have an adventure? Well, why not enter for a chance to win as part of Lisa's Adventure Club, an annual National Parks Pass to share an adventure with your family, maybe a group of friends, whoever you want to. We're giving away one annual National Parks Pass a week all summer long. You go to byuradio.org/adventure to enter for a chance to win. This week's secret word, boots. It'll give you an extra entry. Go and do that today. BYURadio.org/adventure. Now, coming up in 2 minutes, we're going to learn about the unique job of a pop culture storyteller. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Now, there's a lot of moving parts that contribute to pop culture, right? And pop culture has a huge impact on society. I think that we're always just saying, well, you know, in our pop culture, or according to pop culture of the last, you know, 30 years or whatever, we refer to it so much without a full understanding of what we're talking about. But imagine if keeping up on it all was part of your job description. Today, we're excited because we're joined by Scott Ryan. He's an author, publisher, and a television historian, which I didn't realize was a job. And now I'm rethinking all of my career choices. He joins our conversation today to talk about pop culture and how it impacts our society and the different roles of this unique and exciting job. Welcome, Scott.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And I have to tell you, I'm loving the show. I've been listening all morning.
Well, thanks.
And I have a tip to make life better. Oh. Do I have to email it in, or can I?
Please, give it to us right now.
Okay. If you want to make your life better,
uh-huh,
marry someone filthy rich.
Huh? That's good advice. you can follow them with a rich man just as easy as a poor man, right?
That's my dad used to say. My wife didn't do that, and she got a television historian. So,
I love
it. What are you going to do?
Well, listen, you know, but we get to have this conversation right now, so all is not lost, right? You can't pay for good conversation, and I feel like, you know, in television, you know, those who don't watch television a lot sometimes tout it as a sort of a humble brag, right? Like as if they're, you know, curing cancer while they're not, watching television.
Right, exactly.
And those of us who love television realize that it's just good storytelling, which is timeless. I love that this is the first question. I didn't really think this is where I was going to go. But what do you love about television? I feel like I've met a kindred spirit.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I know exactly what you mean, where there's people that are like, oh, I don't even watch television.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then you're not connecting, because what television honestly does, especially I think in America, is it connects us to strangers.
Yes.
So you can be out and somebody, let's say, is wearing a friend's T-shirt, and you might go up to them and say, you know, we were on a break, and
right.
They're going to laugh, and you just bonded with someone immediately. And, you know, that could be kind of highfalutin, and I see eye rolls all the time when I talk about this, but I honestly believe it's what connects us.
I love that this is where we're starting this conversation. I lived in England for a little time, and I felt very alone and isolated. I had little kids, and I didn't get out much. And when I did, I realized that everyone watched a TV show called Pop Idol, which then turned into American Idol, which we all know about now. And I could go into any shop and talk to any stranger and make that human connection by talking about this TV show. So I want to echo what it is that you're saying, that this is a connection that we have.
Yeah. And I think that it is, you know, it's definitely getting fragmented because there's so many avenues. But if you look at like through the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
just about everyone watched Queen's Gambit.
Yeah.
And it was a way, where are you, what episode are you, oh, you don't even know what's coming, okay, I can't talk to you, we're going to wait, you got to get to episode 3. And all of that kind of conversation. I'm a big Twin Peaks fan, I run mm-hmm. a Twin Peaks magazine, and I go out to this festival every year, and, you know, we were out for breakfast, and these people from England had their badge on, and they said, can we sit with you for breakfast? And we were like, yeah. Now we travel to England and stay at their house. They're part of our family. And
I love that.
Things sort of started with me because I was like, can you imagine if today you just walked into McDonald's,
mm-hmm.
saw someone and said, hey, do you watch Everybody Loves Raymond? Good. Sit down. I'm going to eat some fries with you.
Right.
I mean, but honestly, it's what's happened in my life. I've made so many friends through the books and projects that I've worked on.
I love that. And as part of your job as television historian, you're making connections with people like this. And I'm really curious about your perspective on pop culture and really maybe the ways that it affects and seeps into our society that we might not be aware of.
Well, I mean, I think one of the major ones was how the movement of gay marriage happened through shows like Ellen and Will and Grace. I mean, seeing it on TV certainly made a difference. If you go way back into shows like All in the Family, that talked about social issues, certainly Star Trek. I mean, Star Trek is a great example of where they could take something
mm-hmm.
and talk about something that is controversial, but if you make it a Klingon, you know, we can
right.
all, we're not going to get upset and pick our side. So I think those things happen all of the time. My latest book is on moonlighting.
Oh,
and,
love that.
You know, that was a show that pushed so many boundaries of what you could get away with on television. And now all of those things seem quaint, but it was shows like that that moved things.
That's such an interesting perspective on where there can be sort of like a singular series or moment kind of in history that can sort of change the national conversation through art. When you watch TV now, are you looking for cues about where you think that the show will sort of take society, or do you see it as a reflection of things that are happening right now in this moment?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, because something that I think is fascinating is when you watch a show that isn't of this time, but it still comments on this time. And one of the things that I talk about in my books is how when great art reflects right now. It doesn't matter when it was made, because those things change, because all of our opinions change as, you know, as a society. We grow and we adapt. But if it's really well written, if you've created a great character, then that human experience is always going to reflect the time we live in, not so much the time it was created in.
Yeah. I think that another phenomenon that has happened, certainly maybe due to the pandemic, and if you're just joining in on the conversation, we're talking with Scott Ryan about pop culture, how it, as a television historian, it reflects not only what's happening right now, but can also be an indication of where our society sort of is heading and the interest in that. I think that it's interesting that we've had all this time to sort of reflect and watch maybe more TV than we've maybe previously done.
Right.
I think that's a nice way to say it. But there was a phenomenon that was coming where people were not necessarily craving new or exciting or sort of stressful storylines, but we're looking for the comfort of old familiar shows that they'd already seen. What do you think that says about pop culture right now?
Well, in my opinion, I think it has more to do with how television was created. Because I think that in a lot of ways, most shows have just forgotten how to create a good story. And they're so worried about not, you know, don't change the channel. And we better put an explosion here. And we, you know, let's have them swear in the first couple minutes. And
that'll
get them. Know we're edgy.
Yeah.
I'm actually working right now to develop a show. And when I was in this pitch meeting, I told them, I don't want anyone who's an alcoholic. No one's going to be on drugs. You know, no functioning person is also a meth addict.
Right.
And I said, that's not how it works. And it kind of stopped the meeting cold, because people had forgotten, like, that isn't how television used to be. Every character didn't have some horrible addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can tell nice stories, and they still can be dramatic. There's certainly a lot of drama. I've done books on 30-something, Twin Peaks, Moonlighting. You know, a lot of it is from the past, because honestly, those are the interviews I can get.
But interesting.
But I mean, also, the characters were real. You felt something for them. And it doesn't happen very often in TV now.
That's so interesting. So your job as a television historian, I mean, I think a lot of people are really curious about what it is you do on a day-to-day, you know, basis. And what is it that you love about it?
Well, I mean, I love art. I love figuring out how art is created. A lot of times I'm not a fun person to watch TV with, because I'll be trying to figure out how they did that and be like, oh, if they would have just done this, then that would
have
worked.
Do you talk to the TV as well?
It depends. I'm actually such a nerd that I pause the TV. Oh. I would never talk while it was on. I also don't have my phone. This is my other thing. You know, now TV is made to try to make you not look at your phone. Well, I put my phone down when I watch TV, which, you know, drives my children crazy. I'm like, no, you're going to put that down.
No. We got to put it away.
You're going to watch this. You can't cry at an episode of television if you have your phone out. It doesn't work that
way.
You're
not fully invested.
So what I love to do is interview writers, and that's what my books are, oral histories for the most part. And so I you know, try to learn, how did you create this character? How did you craft this? And capture it not with my opinion, but with what actually happened. I mean, I got to interview Sybil Shepherd for this Moonlighting book, and that is, you know, like an incredible honor to talk to someone like her.
Well, tell me a little bit about that interview, because I'm so struck by not only who you get to talk to, but how many interviews that you've had to get people to open up. That must be a memorable one. What was that experience like?
Well, it was honestly scary as all get up. It took me about a year and a half to get the interview. I worked a year and a half to get it.
Wow.
They, you know, she has people to make sure people like me don't get to her. I mean, that's why the whole system is set up.
Right.
But as I was amassing all these other interviews with the directors and writers and producers of the series, a lot of them were calling her and saying, hey, you really should talk to this guy. He, you know, he's honest.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not out to get anyone.
Right. This is not a gotcha.
People are afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what I'm here to do. It's what you say is what goes in the book. I don't change it. So when it finally happened, they were just like, hey, call Sybil. And I'm like, well, she's going to call me. And they're like, no, no, no. Here's her home number.
Oh, wow.
She's waiting. And so, you know, it was kind of hard to dial that number. And
I bet.
She's so sweet. I mean, we're really good friends. We talk all the time now. She sang to me. We talk about old movies.
Oh,
and
man.
I love music. And she is absolutely a dear.
Wow. Wow. You know, it's so interesting because I bet as a writer and an interviewer, you know, and historian, you have so many different questions to ask these, you know, actors and creators of television. And I'm wondering if any of their sort of answers surprised you as a fan.
Yeah, I mean, all the time. What I try to do, my interview trick, I'm going to give it to you, Lisa.
Please. I want it.
Is I only ask them about them.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that makes them feel special. So if I'm talking to, you know, Ken Olin, who is the star of 30-something, of course I'm going to talk about his character, Michael Stedman. Mm-hmm. But if I'm talking to, like, I interviewed the HR person for the David Letterman show because I did a book on the last 6 weeks of David Letterman's late night. I didn't ask her about Dave or Paul. I just asked her about her job. And that makes her feel special. And in learning about that, she's going to tell me a story about Dave that she probably wouldn't, because she knows that I'm not trying to get something. I'm not trying to get you to tell me something you don't want to tell me. I'm just totally interested in you and what you contributed to the late show with David Letterman or Moonlighting or whatever.
Wow. Oh, that's great. So what are you watching right now that has been created in the last couple of years?
Well, right now I'm watching Sweet Tooth on Netflix. It's a show by Jeff Lemire, who's a friend of mine. He is a DC comic book artist, and this is his first show. He's done some work for us on the Twin Peaks magazine. And to watch him become the superstar and do a TV show with Robert Downey Jr. producing is incredible, and it's a great show. My favorite show is The Good Fight. It's on CBS Access. It's a spinoff of The Good Wife, and no one's talking about this show.
Oh, I'll talk to you all day about it. It's so great.
Oh, you watch it?
Yes.
It's so creative.
So creative. I never know where the storyline is going. And that's one thing that I appreciate about good TV, because I feel like it's real and the characters are real. But it's so surprising that it just is entertaining.
I'm trying so hard to get to the Kings, who executive produce it. And, you know, my whole job is to, like, connect. So I know Jay Daniel, because he's the producer of Moonlighting, who produced Sybil, who starred Christine Baranski, who's in The Good Fight.
Yeah.
I'm like, can I use that? Can I connect this to that? So I'm working it.
I love it. And, you know, I love that we're ending this conversation where we began, that television brings in connections and that everyone really is connected and in this. And it's just such a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time, Scott.
Oh, it was so much fun.
That was Scott Ryan, author, publisher, television historian. To find out more about his work, you can follow him on social media or visit his website, scottryanproductions.com. And again, his books, his latest book, Moonlighting and Oral History, is out. Really exciting talking to him and really having that conversation about how much TV really influences our pop culture and can bring people together. And I know it sounds so funny for those who maybe don't watch a lot of TV, but it is reflective of our society and of our culture. And really excited to be able to have that conversation. And before we get too far out, yeah, we need to have some connections. Why not find a connection by going on an adventure? Lisa's Adventure Club. Enter for a chance to win an annual National Parks Pass over at byuradio.org/adventure. This week's secret word is boots. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on our BYU Radio app. We're also over on Sirius XM channel 143. And if you like something you heard, you want to share it with friends, you want to hear it again, you can download our podcast wherever you get to, podcasts. On tomorrow's show, we're going to discuss the impact of rising healthcare costs. Thanks for listening to The Lisa Show.